Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. How are you? Back from a little summer hiatus. I took an impromptu break. I wanted to come back. I was toying with sharing the last few episodes of season two over summer, and I thought, no, let's have a break. And so we can just elongate the season a little bit more. You can probably tell I'm not very good at endings. I can't believe how quickly we have stormed through season two. I've absolutely loved being able to bring you some of these wholehearted, human, deep, honest conversations with some incredible people that I've had the pleasure of working with, or who I know and blessed to be able to call them my friends. And I really hope that you have enjoyed the conversations as much as I have. As you will be listening to this, or as I'm recording, we're just a few weeks away from the launch of The Good Ally. So having this break means that we can skillfully segue into the launch of Good Ally and have you right there with me. I cannot thank you all for your support. If you've pre-ordered, thank you. If you are yet to pre-order, I would appreciate those very much. They're so important in terms of authors' success rate and how that impacts any people who will come after me. And there's even more pressure and weight on Black authors who often are not held to the same standards. So any pre-orders you can make, or just by sharing the link to The Good Ally, which is in your show notes, is greatly, greatly appreciated. And I can't wait for you to have it in your hands, to listen to it in your ears, and for you to be moved by it, to fold the pages, to underline them, to go back again, to re-listen again and again, and to be, you know, I hope changed by it. It's been a labor of love. It's not been easy, but it's been an absolute honor writing it. And yeah, cannot wait for you to have it. But before we go into that spiel, we have a bit of a bumper episode today, so you might need to listen in two chunks, but I could not cut this conversation. I just couldn't edit it. So you get the full effect of my next guest. Before I introduce you, huge shout out to my patrons, as usual. Thank you as ever for your support in helping keeping season two going. I see you. So this episode, without further ado, I get to talk to one half of the incredible duo, the Triple Cripples. And I'm talking to Kim Oliver, and oh gosh, we went well over our time slot. It was like catching up with a friend, and I just loved every aspect of this conversation, and I hope you will too. Before I dive into more about that, the Triple Cripples are a media entity. They have a YouTube channel, they do consultancy, they do campaigning, and a whole lot more. And they're really dedicated to increasing visibility and highlighting the narratives of Black and non-Black women, femmes, and non-binary people of colour living with disabilities. And Kim and I talk about this a lot, but people are so used to seeing Black as being this one-dimensional narrative, as us being a monolith, and often people who intersect with other identities are often just seen as Black. And so we're talking particularly around the intersection of being Black and living with a disability. And we also talk about the intersections of gender and class with race, and how that can impact outcomes and anti-racism work. And I love it. There's, again, no stone left unturned. We talk about the beautiful journey of continuing to become and discover who we are and how we can be in this world and how we can contribute, as well as the importance of adapting your perspective and not staying fixed in this work. There's this real, what we're doing is in anti-racism is undoing what we have learned. And there is this real instinct and desire that I see from people coming to this work, or students, to just want to know all the stuff and to be given all the words, or be given all the language, and to read all the books, and to say tick a box, and then that's job done. That's white supremacy. And being anti-racist is doing the opposite of that and learning to feel comfortable with not knowing and to be continuing to be learning and growing and adapting and changing and enduring and surrendering to the wonder of that. So, yeah, without further ado, I think I'm just going to hand over straight to my conversation with Kim. Let us know what you think over on my Instagram at Nova Reed Official, and snuggle on down with a cuppa of something or a tipple of something and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I am joined by the incredible Kim Oliver, founder or co-founder of Triple Cripples. Welcome, Kim.
Hello. Hello, hello, hello. How are you doing?
I'm good. And you've just helped me segue into my question. I'm good, thank you. Thanks for asking. How are you feeling today?
How am I feeling? Hot. hungry. Are those feelings? Those are feelings, right? Those are valid.
I'll take those.
Yeah. Hot, hungry. Also excited. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I'm looking forward to it. So, yeah.
Amazing. So, Kim, I like to start by getting a bit juicy. Who are you, Kim? Beyond your roles and formal titles, who are you?
Oh, mate. Okay, so who am I? This will throw me into an existential crisis, won't it? Who am I? Who have I been trying to be from birth? What is the purpose of my living?
We're going deep.
Yeah, well, this is it. I think to ask me who I am is a very difficult question for me to answer because, A, we're different people in different environments, in different situations. We're different people to different people within our lives. Mm. We inhabit so many roles, some which we know, some which we don't know. But I guess for me, I've never liked the pressure of inhabiting roles. Mm. It's probably why my parents thought I was aimless.
That resonates.
So I spend my life in learning. I'm existing, right? I'm inhabiting this physical body, trying to figure out who I am, and who I am in the context of the world, in context of nature, in the context of others, in the context of my physical experience, my spiritual experience, my emotional experience. But I'm just a human existing and living. Although I say I'm just a human, but I also refer to myself as a goddess. So, yes. You know, I'm a goddess having a human experience right now.
I take that.
That's who I am. Yeah.
Oh, that is beautiful. Thank you for going there with me. And if it feels comfortable for you to share, where did you grow up and what was that like?
I grew up in my head. And secondly, the world was just a secondary element of that. Yeah, no, I did. I very much grew up in my mind. The physical experience that I had outside of my mind was felt very unrealistic by comparison to the world that existed inside of myself. And there were lots of incongruencies. So though I was located in London and in my parents' household, I very much existed outside of that context as a person. So, well, I've never said this out loud before, but that's genuinely how I feel. Where I grew up was definitely in my mind, and possibly in the books that I read as well as a child. I loved reading. But yeah, I grew up in London. That's the physical place that I inhabited, and in a house with, you know, parents and a sibling at first and cousins and extended family, as is the case for lots of people who are the children of previously colonized people who come to the UK. So yeah, that's where I grew up and what it was like. I mean, it was a rich tapestry of experiences, not all of which were negative, because, you know, we all have every side of the coin in our life and upbringing. But it was rich in the sense that it was a diversity of culture and thought within the house. I have a Caribbean parent from a small island. I have an African parent from a well-known colony in West Africa. I also was going to school in London with lots of different people from different places. Though, yes, it was the majority white. There were people from different cultures there. I was growing up in an English society, watching English and American TV programs, reading books by primarily white authors, because at the time that's what we had available to us. And so it was a lot of different things all in one pot, right? And you have to navigate and make sense of that and know which rules apply to where and when they apply and how to use certain rules to exploit other rules. And, you know, you learn how to be, how to think, how to act. And you also learn which rules can't be compromised on, right? Which ones apply regardless of the environment or regardless of where you are. Though I do think the ones within my house, for me at least, overshadowed and dominated the ones that existed outside the house. Like, you know, those rules and those edicts and those morals that my parents taught were not, they weren't things that I could fling away and abandon the minute I left the house. Like, I had to adhere to them. And some of the ethical things, like those remained, even if the society outside did not reflect my parents' practice, I still had to adhere to those things because that's what I was taught. So even if I was taught, oh, you know, you tell the truth at all times, you don't steal, you don't do this, you don't do that, but the outside world wasn't operating according to those rules, I couldn't then go and adjust and adapt to make sure I could survive in the outside world because it didn't match my parents' ideas. Like, I had to match my parents' ideas regardless of whether it was hurting me outside, right? And in some ways, just even the juxtaposition of their perception of what the world should be like or the worlds they came from, what they were like, and what they thought this world would be like based on those colonial teachings, was so different from my reality, right? And you can't communicate those as a child who is growing up with the ideas that children are supposed to be do as they're told, and, you know, so
be seen and not heard.
So it was an interesting childhood. My parents were extremely loving people in a world that wasn't full of loving people. That includes their family. And so it was a very weird thing. You grow up really quickly when you see those disparities in the way adults conduct themselves and live. And so, yeah, I existed in my head, but I was always very curious, always very interested in things, in people, in people. I'm so interested in people and why they were who they were and how they came to be that way, what they were thinking, what they were feeling, needing to understand. I wanted to understand everything, even sometimes to my detriment, often to my detriment. And I was always asking why. I was always asking why, not because I was challenging, because I wanted to understand. And I felt my understanding would allow me to, would give me freedom. And yeah, I felt like understanding would give me freedom. And so the less understanding I had, the more restricted and imprisoned I felt, just in general, about everything. Yeah.
Where did that, or when did that desire to, well, understand, but probably before that, that interest in people, can you remember if there was a defining moment when that was very apparent for you, this being interested in people?
I think my mother is what started that in me, just because, you know, much like the children of a lot of people who migrated here or were invited, like, my mum was always working. And so I had an interesting family structure growing up in that my main caregiver was my father. They, my mom and dad got together and decided. My father did not want to leave his children with anyone. As a child who'd been left behind by Windrush parents, he didn't want his children to be left with anyone else, right? Yes. Because he'd experienced what that felt like. And he never, one of the things he always decided, if he had children, he never wanted to leave them with anyone, not family, not care, nobody. And so he was like, look, one of us has to stay home with the children. And my mom's career was going quite well. My mom's very bright. And my father is not a misogynist. So he didn't think that.
That there was anything wrong with that.
Thank you. There was nothing wrong with that. So as far as he was concerned, okay, the children need looking after. Okay, if your career is going well and you really, you know, you actually have the potential to do well in that respect, okay, let me look after the children. So my father is who was doing my hair and plaiting it and cooking and cleaning and taking us to school and bringing us home. So he's who I know from my formative years. Even now, we still, you know, Mother's Day, it's my father we kind of celebrate most of the time. Like, and bring my mother stuff as well. But he's like my mom. And I know in the context of what Western society has told you a mother is, right? And who fulfills that role, right?
Who's the sole caregiver?
And what the gender norm is. That's what. So when I did see my mother, my early memories of her, so I'm talking about my infancy, so maybe between 0 to 3.5, that I would see this woman. I knew there was this really lovely, warm woman who I'd see in this blue uniform at night, sometimes late if I'd be up. I'd see her at nights, and she'd always have this wonderful, warm smile. And I'd be like, wow, she's so nice. And I'd go, I'd get to hug her, and, you know, I'd breastfeed. And I'd always be like, wow, she's so, I wonder why she's so nice to me. She's just really lovely. And so I think my curiosity about why she was nice to me, like that understanding that, oh, this is because I was too young to really be engaged with society says a woman does A, B, or C, like, because that wasn't my reality, right? So I was always curious about who this woman was that I'd see once in a while who, you know, would turn up and give me things that I needed and be loving and caring and like, so I think that's, if I really analyze it and think about it, I always used to question, like, I wonder why she's so lovely. And I used to be like, oh, wow, she's so pretty. This pretty angel just turns up, you know, and just always her voice so gentle and hello mommy, how are you? And she never spoke to me like I didn't understand what she was saying. Even at that young age, she never kind of changed her. And actually, to be honest, that's not just my perception, because when I grew up and I had little brothers, and she would talk to them like that from when they were in the womb. So I knew that it wasn't a case of I've perceived my mother as speaking to me like I'm a sentient being. She was speaking to me like that because she believed I was a sentient being. And just that gentle nature and spirit, I always used to wonder about it. And how come? And who is this woman and why? And why is she so kind and why is she so nice? It begs other questions as to why a child would think, why is someone being nice to me? But it's just genuinely I was curious as to where that came from, and I think that's what sparked it, and that loving warmth with which she met me was something that I was always fascinated by. Even till now, I'm still fascinated by my mother still. And she picks up the phone and she's super kind of gleeful about speaking to me. I'm like, yeah, but why? What did I do? Why are you so happy to speak to me? Like, I know I'm great. Yes. Okay. Wonderful. Let's get over that. What's with this sunny disposition? What's going on?
And that is such a profound answer. That's beautifully profound. Thank you.
Yeah. Wow. I've never had to answer that before. So I'm learning things about what I know about myself. Thank you.
All welcome here. You're very, very welcome. I'm moving around a bit, but because your father wasn't a misogynist. And that was your family structure, and it was natural and normalized. Do you think that had any impact on your interaction with gender norms as an adult?
I think it had a profound effect on my interaction with gender norms even as a child, right? Because you're living in structures that contradict what you are experiencing, and you're around a lot of criticisms of what your reality is. Because as I said, like, my parents are nuclear, but they have extended family. They have, you know, we did have family around us. There are people who were critical of that structure, who did, you know, there were perceptions. You hear things and you see things. And also you see TV, you see magazines, you see, like, no one's structure is like your structure, right? You also see a lot of people who don't have the structure. So it's usually like a single mom or something like that. In my school, in my primary school, in my class, I think it was two of us who, and even in my secondary school class, I think there were, of the black children at least, I was the only one I knew of the black children who had two parents in a household. Okay. And then in primary school, it was kind of, there were a few of us who had two parents in a household, but it wasn't something that was like, it's something that you knew that you didn't necessarily talk about because so many people had a different experience. And where there were two parents in the household, it was the heteronormative gender roles that existed. Whereas mine contradicted both of those things on two terms. Okay, first of all, the two parents in the household, then they're not adhering to gender roles. And in my house, my parents actually didn't for themselves believe in gender roles. Whatever needs doing for the household is what needs doing, and everyone pitches in. But outside influence in terms of gender norms meant that there were certain imbued things that they kind of adhere to. Yeah, but you should like the kitchen because you're a girl. Even though my father would be in the kitchen cooking and expects all of us to know how to cook, it'd be like, and also it was the idea, and that wasn't necessarily from him, that was from my mom's family, and that idea that he didn't want me to be perceived a certain way by them because their culture is so patriarchal. And so when it got to a point where I was interested in certain things or I wasn't interested in certain things, I think he felt like, oh no, maybe we didn't do something because now she's going to be perceived a certain way and it's going to make it harder for her in the world. Mm. Or when I was interested, when he was doing carpentry and I wanted to be around the teaching that he got, the patriarchal teaching he got about the delicacy or the delicate nature of women prevented him from allowing me to participate or learn. You know, he'd shoo me away, you know, because I don't want you to get hurt. You're a girl, like, it's not. And so though they were quite open, there were kind of a lot of contradictions there, right? Because their openness, they're the first generation of openness. There are going to be a lot of kinks. And it's sheer miracle that they decided to be so open and managed to find each other, to be honest, because the environments that they were from didn't cultivate those thinkings. It's their own kind of exploration and desires to be different to who came before them. You know, my mom didn't grow up in a feminist environment, but she was a staunch feminist because of what she read and what she learned, and she wanted to apply that to her life. My dad didn't know anything about feminism. He just knew what he didn't want to be, how he didn't want to treat people, how he wanted to raise children, and how he believed, where he believed women were placed, which happened to be in line with my mom's feminist learnings, which said a lot to me about what education and the value of it, and whether it's to do with academia or to do with experience and being able to extrapolate and kind of reason and reckon with life. And so it was quite a juxtaposition in a lot of ways. So you become a teenager, you become an adult, and you have ideas and thoughts about who you should be, in contrast to who you actually are.
And
what is expected of you. Based on what society told me, I didn't ever really feel like a girl. I knew I was a girl, because I had a vagina. And I was told as a girl, but based on what society said, I didn't fit, not just ideologically in terms of the roles, but the things I liked or was interested in. And the way I looked, I was bigger than most of the boys that I was around it when I was growing up. I was taller. I wasn't white. I didn't have straight hair. I didn't have soft curly hair. I had very Bantu, West African kind of features. I have a broad nose. I have thick lips. I have kind of wide eyes. And those things weren't seen as feminine, right? Those things are also often seen as ugly.
In the West, yeah.
In the West, yes. I had broad shoulders. That's also seen as a manly trait, right? And so there were all of these things that didn't fit with what I was told was feminine. And then also people used to call me dark-skinned, so I thought I was dark-skinned. It's only now there's a variety of people. I'm like, well, if they were calling me dark-skinned, what were they calling people who have a darker hue to me? Do you know what I mean? But also being plump meant that I was perceived as more dark-skinned than I was, because fatness was associated with specifically with blackness in a way that is very racialized and we don't acknowledge, right? Yeah. And so it was a very strange, it's a strange experience. So you're existing, but you're existing outside of the world. You're within it, living, but you're existing outside of it because you just don't fit. And that's what I knew. That's what I knew. And, you know, it, in some ways, you spend time contorting yourself, trying to work out how to fit. And the only ways that I could never fit physically, because there was nothing, I couldn't chop anything off. I couldn't, like, change the color of my skin. I didn't even know that that was an option. I couldn't wear certain clothes because I came from a very strict household. That wasn't an option for me. And men like me didn't get pocket money to say I can go to the shops and buy my own thing. So fashion-wise, that was a dead end.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So that wasn't an option to kind of fit.
Yeah.
But the only way I could try and fit was to make myself, as in who I was, smaller, right? Be the most accommodating, the most open, the best listener, the most kind, the biggest giver, never expect anything in return, just kind of, and not be, maybe I wasn't able to achieve this, but at the time I thought that I was able to, especially around men, be of servitude and not give my opinion too much so as to alienate or isolate them or make them feel like I was challenging them. Because I was told by my grandmother that you're already tall, you're already big, you shouldn't be so tall, you'll intimidate. So humble yourself, humble yourself, right?
Yeah.
And so I found myself trying to become an angel in human form. And though some of those things may have been innate characteristics for me, I've always been quite empathetic and thoughtful. The amplification of them, almost like the caricature of what those things would be, is what became kind of my way of fitting. Because if I didn't fit in all these other ways, like I could at least be something to you that would provide comfort, that would provide safety, that would provide the things that I didn't have, right?
Yeah.
And so, and also that is partly in line with some of the tropes we have about big black women, the idea of being the caregiver, the idea of being the savior and being all things to someone and being the safe place. Yeah.
The nurturer. Being somewhere
you could, the nurturer, and physically being able to nurture the person you go for if you want to hug. Kim, you're so soft. You know, I always feel safe. Oh, you're so, and even taking up that role, because I had that physicality and that height and that strength, the physical strength, I knew I did. When I was around, especially women, my role was as protector. That's how I felt. I felt protected over them. I felt like I needed to protect them, even sometimes around dudes as well. And so there's a point where you cannot contort yourself anymore. It becomes painful because there's a part of you that is empty every time you're giving, right? Yeah. And it's craving for recognition. It's craving for someone to be like, I want to hold you too. Yeah. What, do you need anything? Are you sad also? Do you have any problems? But that perception that you don't need anything, you don't have any issues, you don't have any problems, or you'll be fine, you'll always be fine. That pain of that causes you to start resenting yourself at first. But after you've finished resenting yourself, you start resenting others. Unfortunately, you don't know how to break out of the cycle. So you do and resent. You resent and you do, and it becomes worse and worse and worse. And that is, it's beyond gender roles for me. That's, yes, part of it is to do with the gender roles that you don't fit into. And then, you know, that idea of what desirability is and how that fits into things, and that otherness that comes with being a minoritized person. There's so much stuff, but it for me, at least, there were multiple factors that combined to create that cycle. And it took a lot of internal analysis. As someone who existed in my head, it probably wasn't that difficult for me to constantly be picking away at myself. But in terms of analyzing and going in depth into why, that why is what probably saved me, right? And what probably changed, started to shift those things. That why does this keep happening? That why do I feel like this? That why do I feel so empty? Why do I feel like I'm everyone's friend, but I don't have a friend? Why do I, you know, just those whys. And why do I always have to be the one? And why is this expected of me? And why can't I feel sad? And why can't I get hurt? And why? And why am I ugly? Like, I know I'd agreed to it, but why am I ugly? Why am I ugly? Right. And so that why is kind of what has governed, I guess, as you asked me in the beginning, me finding out who I am.
Because we, in all of this contortion and morphing and assimilating and shrinking in order to belong, we lose parts of ourselves. We lose parts of our humanity. So, and there are many people who are not, who have not yet, and some who never find their way back. So the fact that you had that, I guess that inherent, it's a skill to be able to self-interrogate. It's a skill. That level of self-awareness, I think there's, as with everything, there's different ends of the spectrum where we can over analyze and things, but it sounds like that was useful and necessary for you.
I think so. And I have to, I genuinely always have to credit my mother for this, because watching her raise my little brothers made me realize how much of that skill she gave me before I could even speak. Even when my mother was changing their nappies, she'd be explaining to them what she's doing and why, and how she's going about it. Yes. Like, so before you're even able to kind of articulate yourself in a certain way, you understand that everything has a reason. Everything that happens has a process and has a reason. So even when you are doing things that aren't necessarily good, my mom will ask you to explain what it is that happened and what you did and why we're here now, right? And so though some of it I feel like is a bit overboard, because like, as someone, a child who's already predisposed to thinking, it made me super hyper vigilant.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Yeah.
But I think the benefit of that, at least for the children, those of her children who are not hypervigilant, is that you know your positioning in the grand scheme of how the chain reaction of events happen in life. You know that if you kick a ball super hard, it's going to hit the wall, probably ricochet, it might hit the window. If it hits the neighbor's window and it breaks, that might be a problem. So you're aware before you do things that you as a person, as an individual, have impact on the world around you. Yes. And so the things you do aren't just about you all the time, right?
Yes.
And I think that even just those types of things allow you to then be analytical. They allow you to be reflective. You think about things maybe a little bit longer before you do them. You might still do them, but you think about them and you might know that you might have thought about the different consequences and you decided which you're willing to live with. But it's a very useful skill. It's useful. It can be a burden.
Yes.
But I think it's useful. It can be a burden in a world that is full of a lack of that skill, a lack of
And very individualistic thinking, which, you know, we're probably seeing magnified since the pandemic, the impact of that individualistic thinking. And your method, the why I'm just intrigued by it is how I teach anti-racism is very much about getting curious about behavior, instinctive, reflexive behavior, thoughts, feelings. And if people are saying something racist, and this is for people who are not racialized as black, to get curious and ask them why they said that. So that then goes back on them to reflect on, well, why do I think that? Well, why did I say that? You know, sometimes that works with people who are open to engage and other times it doesn't. But it does. It forces that introspection, doesn't it?
I think that the why of things is important. We accept so many things as a given, even about ourselves. I think it would be very difficult for people to hold certain belief systems or thought patterns or exhibit certain behaviors or exist in the world in certain ways if they asked why a lot. They asked why about even themselves, their own motivations. Okay, I like bread. Why do I like bread? No, but it's literally as deep as that. And I think it's important for us to kind of understand all of those things, because you might not actually like bread.
You
might
tasteless.
Just like someone who, thank you. You might have been in a situation where someone baked bread who you really loved and they gave it to you at this particular point in time. And actually what you like is that person and the association. And even that is important to know, because then if bread has been giving you kind of gastrointestinal problems, then you're able to drop it out and find the actual thing that actually gave you joy, right?
But, you know, there's a comfort to bread for me. It's just like, it will fill me up. It's quick. Well, it's easy.
There you go. But even knowing that, and it's kind of knowing the knowing, right? And it's like you said with the anti-racism, if someone knows where a particular thing is coming from, and why it exists in the way it does within them, it then changes. If someone understands the why of where they have, where that belief comes from, why they're thinking that, and how it became part of their natural thought pattern, often, like when we actually look through these whys, people actually don't know a lot of the time why they really, really don't know why they feel these things. They know that that's what they've heard. They know that that's what someone said. Okay, so but why did they? Oh, well, why are black people lazy? Well, because they are.
Yeah, like, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
But there why? What is the reason? When's the last?
Yeah.
So the ones you're calling lazy. Okay, so how many times have you been in a situation where you've been able to encounter an actual lazy black person? That is a laziness that is exclusive to them. That's not a laziness that exists in everyone. That's a laziness that is so categorically lazy that it exists outside of the spectrum of what we understand to be lazy in humans in general.
Yeah.
When have you encountered that? And we often don't, we don't have answers for those things, but we don't get asked to ask why. And I think that's to do with the education system as well. Like it's the way we're educated and socialized is not to question the status quo.
Exactly.
That keeps people in power. Like, I don't need you to know the inner workings of anything. I don't even need you to know yourself to know that you are not happy with the status quo. You're not happy with capitalism. Yeah. You're not happy with patriarchy. I don't need you to know that stuff, because that will prevent me from having power over you and your world and your life. And so, no, it doesn't serve me to get you to ask why. It doesn't.
It serves me to keep you ignorant.
There you go.
Whoa, I knew I'd enjoy this conversation. I've just seen the Times. I'm like, oh my goodness. I know the answer to this, but I would love you to share for my listeners. And it probably won't come as a surprise for many, but why was the Triple Cripples founded? What was the driving force behind that?
Well, we found that I and Jamal Care come from completely different contexts. I became disabled as an adult. She was disabled from before her first birthday.
Yeah.
Yet, as strangers who met on the internet, we had the same sentiments and understanding of the world, in that there was a lack of representation of people who existed in the world the way we did. Yeah. A complete lack of representation. And Jamal Kaya always calls it a lacuna in the media landscape. To find, and this, people, I think, trivialize representation a lot, because a lot of the people who trivialize it, they are represented. And yeah. So they don't necessarily feel the impact of a lack of representation on the social, economic, educational, financial, medical lives or any other type. They don't feel it. If you have zero representation of yourself outside of your actual self, you are an anomaly in a world full of billions of people. You know the world is full of billions of people. You are alone. Mm-hmm. You don't have any examples of who you could be. You don't have any examples of the acceptable ways for you to dress, to think, to act. You don't have any examples of what you're supposed to expect from the world, from other people, from systems. You don't have any examples of what it is like for you to move through the world, or what is wrong with the ways you're being treated, or what's wrong with the systems that you interact with, what's wrong with the families you're born into. Like, you don't have any examples of any other way of being except that which you are in.
Yeah.
And even that, navigating that without a point of reference can be difficult. It can be near impossible sometimes. Yeah. If you think about it, like, we all exist as social beings. No human being is an island.
No.
But to have complete lack of representation makes you an island, right? You can be in a family full of people. If you're the only Black disabled person in your family, what is that?
Yeah.
And especially if you live in a society that inherently is ableist, inherently is racist, anti-Blackness is rife, and it can also be internalized, right?
Yeah.
So if you think about, and we've been talking about this a lot lately in all of our interviews, because it keeps coming up, but if you think about the impact of anti-Blackness and ableism as it pertains to the fallout, or even during the transatlantic enslavement of African people, and those ideas happening for generations and generations, the idea of unworthiness, the idea that disability is a punishment, the idea that disability means that you are no longer useful, the idea that disability or having no value, that means you do not deserve life, because when they were breeding us, like in battery farm style things, those who were giving birth to disabled children, those who became disabled during childbirth,
discarded.
What happened to them? There you go.
Yeah.
And so if you think about generation and generation of that happening over and over again, and also once you become disabled through the sheer horrific work conditions that you're dealing with.
On plantations.
No longer being able to work, no longer being able to even get the little that you were getting, no longer being seen as having a modicum of value to those who were in charge, and no longer being able to help the group because we were working and having to depend on each other to survive. You're now a burden, right?
Yeah.
You're no longer, those ideas don't just go away. They don't just disappear. That's generation after generation, hundreds of years of that being imbued into the culture, passed down generationally, now is embedded in our genetics, those ideas. That's not just an opinion anymore. That is deep-rooted stuff. If you're not having to deal with that in your own family setting, as someone who's come into the world as disabled, who perhaps is no longer euthanized, and so you're having to exist, religion added to, let's not even add religion to how religion portrays illness and disability in religious books and has used it over time. What does that mean for you? How do you experience the world and life just as an individual in that isolating situation? Especially when no one wants to talk about it, you know, in our communities, it's also quite taboo. Yeah. So not only do you have this experience of isolation, but you're not even, in a lot of ways, you're hidden and not spoken about. So you can't even learn about yourself in kind of passing. You can't, it's a completely isolating experience. And so for us, experiencing the world, and people will always reference the Paralympics and be like, oh, but they're Paralympics. And they'll be like, what about Ade Adepita? And it's like, okay, it's good that he exists. That's wonderful. It's good that Vanessa Wallace exists. It's good that these people exist. But the fact that that's what you're having to reference, Black people are a world majority.
Let's pause on that. Let's pause. But again, it's like, be grateful for the scraps.
Yeah.
Be grateful for the bare minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. And where has it the only from? Ones? Thank you. And the only ones who will recognize are the ones that are providing you with titillation. Because let's be very honest about the Paralympics.
Yeah.
Do you, as a nation, do people respect Paralympians as actual athletes? Do they treat our athletes like that? They don't treat Paralympians with that kind of respect. The Paralympics is almost like what society has used to make themselves feel better. Well, if that person with one leg can swim, what's stopping you, as opposed to this person's an athlete?
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? And so
who's trained?
Thank you. Who's trained? Who's probably healthier and fitter than you could be on any given day? What do you mean if that could
100%
you could do it?
Yeah.
You cannot. Look. Anyway. it's irritating me. I find it so irritating because and that's the thing, right? That's not representation of and that's not representation of everyday disabled people either.
Exactly.
Because if you're using that as representation for Black disabled people, I'm sorry, but most people are not athletes in life.
Yes.
Why am I not allowed to just exist without having to be extraordinary?
There we go.
Right?
Superhuman.
Mm-hmm. Superhuman. But Black people in general are relegated to that lane. If you are not being extraordinary in some way or superhuman in some way, it's almost like you're not really being a good Black person, are you?
Yeah.
You're not valuable.
Yeah.
You're not seen as deserving of your space. Because you have to be Malcolm X, or you have to be, I've forgotten the name of one of the ladies who did that mathematical thing for NASA, and in that film that they did.
Catherine Johnson.
Like, oh. Yeah, they were like, oh, yes, this is great. We can do a movie about three Black women because they were supercomputers. Like, it's like they were doing things that computers couldn't do at the time. Like, are you being serious? Like, that's the only way we can exist. And if we're not that, then somehow when we're looking at statistics for populations, the way we're relegated into either superhuman or villain, and it's like most Black people are just hardworking, everyday people who are struggling to get through life. They never get counted.
Yeah.
They don't exist.
Yeah. And like so, we can't, and I'm saying this, with no intention to diminish, but I'm saying this with intention that we're not allowed to be mediocre.
No, but I mean, as someone who believes that Black people can't be mediocre, like I, because we're just fantastic and amazing.
Well, there's that. It's superhuman or it's inferior.
Yes. And even our mediocrity is seen as inferior to the inferiority of others. And what I mean by this is, let's say a Black person, there's a test and you get 50%. Someone else getting 50%, they'll be seen as getting 50%. You'll be seen as losing 50%, right?
Yeah.
And so even if we're saying that 50% is a failing mark, your failure is never seen as equal to that. Your failure is like, it's, you might as well have not even done the test. You are just, and so it's not a, I know we say it's not a level playing field, but it's definitely not, even in terms of just existing. You can't just exist. I can't just go down the road with my hair in two plaits. That's seen as it's unkempt. People will be asking me if I have mental health issues. People will be saying, and not to stigmatize mental health issues, but the fact that I can't just exist in my natural state and go to the shops is a problem. I can't just be. I can't just be. There is always an expectation and always an idea. I'm sorry. You asked me why we started Triple Cripples. So
I'm just enjoying. I'm just enjoying where it goes. I did, and I think we're weaving there. We're weaving there.
Yeah, but that's, you know, and those things, all of that is part of it. And so if we put that in the context of being a Black disabled person and not having representation, it means that your health outcomes are different. Black disabled adults, the statistics, the CDC did a study. And we have the worst life outcomes in all key life areas. That is not an accident. That is directly linked to lack of representation. Not, and we're not just talking about media when we talk about representation. We're talking about in decision making. We're talking about in education. We're talking about in policy making. We're talking about in all of those things. And you can't make policies about people you don't recognize exist.
Of course.
You just can't.
Yeah.
If I don't consider you to be human, I'm not going to consider you in certain things. Like, I'm just not. The way I treat you in terms of healthcare is going to be very different. Your needs aren't going to be as pressing as the real disabled people. Because when I don't represent disabled people, what happens is in the healthcare system, at least in my experience and anecdotally for other Black people, and you see this in the statistics surrounding pregnancy and Black women in childbirth, is that I get treated according to my racialized identity as opposed to my need.
Yeah, so you're just Black. I'm just black. Yeah.
And so even if I've come in presenting with all of the things that someone who is white is presenting, I don't have needs because as a Black person, you are here to, you know, exploit the system. You're a liar. You don't feel pain. You exaggerate. You're not rambunctious. You're bullshy and demanding and intimidating and loud, and you don't have any needs. You just came to this country. That's what clouds the vision. They may not say it to you. They may very much think they're well-meaning and giving you the same time as day as they're giving everyone else, but they're not. Yeah. And the things they'll suggest to you, even to do with gatekeeping, right? Mm. Gatekeeping of information that might be beneficial to you, of services that might help you out. If I don't see you and I don't recognize you as part of the deserving group, you will not hear about it. Do you know the amount of disabled Black people who don't have the social services that they need because professionals have not given them the information because they haven't seen them as deserving. They haven't seen them as part of that deserving group, of the group that it's created for.
Yeah.
It's, that's why representation is important, right? Because of those things.
It's also, I mean, on the extreme, it could also save lives, representation in this way. It can and does save lives. And I'm, as you shared about that, I'm recounting a story that was shared with me that I actually share about in my book about a Black person experiencing serious mental health and needing support. And instead of getting support, getting blamed, as almost like they brought it on themselves, and just this parallel of, and they are now great friends, but a white person and a Black person in a psychiatric ward presenting with the same illness and getting very different outcomes. The white person was giving access to psychological services at home and ongoing support. And the Black person was told that they needed to attend a parenting class, which was however far away from where they lived, and right in the middle of the day when they also needed to work to be able to pay their bills and look after their children. Yeah.
That's not surprising. Like, if you think about the fact that, you know, white people created a whole mental health category to describe Black people not wanting to be in horrific, life-threatening situations.
Yeah. They draped pneumonia, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, they named...
You, yes.
Black people wanting to escape...
from slavery.
Was pathologized and made into a mental health condition.
Yes.
No, we just don't want to be enslaved, thanks.
Yeah.
There's...
And so that is and these things don't just go away, Nova. These things stay within the systems and institutions, because then it's like you're presenting with depression. It's laziness. You just don't want to work. I'm sorry. You've run away from something. You just don't want to work. You're lazy. That's the same thing.
Same thread.
It's the same theme. And so it's like these things, like we cannot understate how important it is to see yourself in the world, and especially in a world that is busy tearing you down, busy rejecting you, busy telling you how you're not good enough, busy kind of working against your survival in so many different ways. Mm. You need to be able to have someone, as you said, to help provide context and be like, hey, firstly, you're not alone. Secondly, this is messed up. Thirdly, these might be the tools that you can use to access what you need. Fourth, like you're not alone. Again, you're not alone. We're here. Yeah. I'm here. Yeah. And this is what life could look like. Let's all figure it out together. That's so important. There are people who have contacted us who are like, oh, before you guys, all of this was in my head. I didn't think it was real. And we're talking about basic things sometimes that in our YouTube videos, we don't go into as much depth as we do in our talks and in our lectures or workshops. And in our YouTube videos, we're talking about very basic things. Yeah. And there are lots of white disabled people who've spoken about those things, but they haven't applied to us in the same nuanced way, right? And so you of still course. Don't feel like you're being heard or listened to. And often Black people are, and people of color, excluded from conversations about disability within those communities. There's a lot of racism. People think because you're disabled, you can't be racist. This is not true. Whiteness is a thread, a beautiful thread that goes across everything. You can be poor and white. You can be disabled and white. You can be of a different ethnicity to an English person and white. And, you know, it's not. And because remember, we have to remember whiteness is phenotypical for the most part, right? Mm-hmm. For the most part, like it's how you're perceived in the world. So you can believe and feel in your heart that you are a minoritized person, but how you show up in the world is going to be the most prominent aspect of how you're treated, especially when you're dealing with other people. And so there will be things that, though you carry other identities, you might be queer, you might be disabled, you might be, there are things that you will never experience in terms of being racialized as non-white, as other, as the other from what is seen as supreme, right?
Yes, yes.
So it's so important for us to have, those of us who exist outside of that structure, to have representation and to have people who are like, okay, this and this is how I felt. And so that isolation turns into empowerment, and that empowerment turns into action and turns into, okay, we're seen and heard. And also so those outside of the experience have a point of reference with which to adjust themselves and make changes and be accountable. Because if you're silent, and if there's no one talking about it, and if no one hears, and you're in the desert by yourself in a hole, not even screaming, nobody ever has to be accountable for your death.
Yeah.
No one.
Yeah.
No one. So that's why we created the thing. And, you know, it's been great just finding community with Jamal Care, because she was the only other Black disabled person I knew. Like, young woman, you know, who I knew. You hear about disability in our community is kind of not with the word disability. You might hear that someone's ill sometimes, and, you know, you might hear someone died and there's hush-hush, and you hear people get ill suddenly. It's like people go from 0 to 100. There's no middle part of them gradually becoming ill. And some of that is due to the silence. Some of that is due to the feeling of unworthiness that makes you go through so much pain and hardship and aching before you even go to the doctor, before you even go and find out what's wrong, before you talk to anyone about it, before, you know. And so often we have late diagnosis for diabetes, for heart disease, for all of these things. And it's all to do with that lack of representation, the lack of normalizing the idea that we exist in different ways. The body is the body, right?
Yes.
And situations are situations. And not having that confounds these issues and also stops us from being able to analyze that particular aspect of anti-blackness that exists within us.
Yeah.
We're not able to interrogate that if we don't recognize illness and disability as real things that affect us and are just part of life. And they're part of life for everyone. And it doesn't make us less than. Mm. It doesn't mean that you're not useful. It doesn't mean that you're not worth your space. It doesn't mean that you're not who you are. It's just another way of experiencing being human on the planet, right?
Yeah.
And it just is what it is.
Yeah. I'm just going to repeat because it came to mind and then you said it, it's just a part of being human. But because we're so often presented with narrative versions of being human, we're told, I mean, again, language that used to be used, particularly for people who had learning disabilities or invisible disabilities, I think were called or referred to in Britain as the mentally subnormal.
Yeah.
So again, it's the otherness being placed on something that is a standard of which we're all being told we have to aspire to, or that is normal. And it's not, it's just different. We exist differently. We exist in different bodies. And I think it has caused so much damage and wounding and it continues to. And I think and it will continue to until representation continues to improve and more understanding of the variety of ways we exist in our full humanity.
Mm. And I think it has to be, you know, the intersection of disability, race, and gender has to be at the core of any anti-racism. Otherwise, it's not anti-racism, right? Because we have to understand the ways in which...
it's all linked.
Yes, completely linked. Completely. Completely. And you know, when we talk about anti-racism, we're also talking class comes into it.
Of course.
In terms, and so those four elements, how that you can't remove one from the other.
You know,
you can't. And so
they're all intrinsically linked.
Yeah. It has to be at the center. It has to be at the center. And if it's not, then what are you doing? You're saying you're doing the work. You're saying all these wonderful things, but
it's surface not. Level.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the thing. As you dig deeper, because, you know, as you dig deeper, you discover more. And then you discover more. And then it's like you're pulling this. I've got an image of wool. You're unraveling a ball of wool and then you think that is linked. And for me, it's really about joining the dots. And that's been my own individual journey as well, because I also don't think that you can, the more I leaned into anti-racism and teaching, I guess, or being a vehicle to help people better understand, the more I was like, I cannot do this work without interrogating my own anti-blackness. Like, oh, hello. So it's this constant discovery, discovery. And the more you unpick, the more you understand. And I don't think you will ever know everything. I think it's a constant journey of becoming and discovering. And so as long as people are going in with that intention that you're never going to know it all and the box is, you know, there's no tick box and there will be things that you get and then suddenly there'll be things that you don't know and it's like unpeeling layers and starting over again. And I think if people go in with that understanding and that intention, then that's a realistic and a human place to be with it, because there's so much that's hidden.
Yeah.
Unless you have the desire to look for it and interrogate. And I am on that journey and I have been on it. Like what I was teaching in 2018 is very different to what I'm teaching now. And I say that as somebody who's immersed in the work, like I'm continuously learning and unpeeling.
Yeah. And so it should be. And the idea that things should be static is a white supremacist kind of conditioning anyway. Yeah, like the idea that something should stay this way for hundreds and hundreds. Yeah. That's not, nothing in life is like that. Like that's, if we're talking about decolonizing anything, even the way in which we perceive knowing has to change. As you said, how can you will always be learning new things, and those new things that you learn are supposed to allow you in context to adjust your perspectives.
Yes.
And to, you know, change your viewpoints and vantage point from which you then launch out into the world again, right? And so if you understand that, that things are, states are constantly changing, and there is no way in the world that you are supposed to stay the same way. I think there's a word for it in the English language where they call waters that remain still and don't get refreshed, stagnant, right? And we see that as a bad thing. But somehow when it comes to these types of things, when it comes to so-called knowledge, we're like, no, but that's done. The way it's always been. That's it's finished. So this is what we'll teach for the next 30 years. For the next 50 years, we'll be talking about these two men. And that's all that, that's the foundation. It's like, yeah, but did they, what did they know? And now we know that actually the time that they came from was a bit problematic. So perhaps we should be interrogating what's going on around there.
A bit problematic, you know, is an understatement. Yeah. But that's it. I think there's an element if you are... There is an element of surrender that is absolutely necessary to embody this work properly. Surrender of not knowing, surrender of causing harm, surrender of just surrendering. And because I also think, you know, the more you surrender, the more you learn. And then that impacts how you show up in the world, how you work, how you parent, how you exist and be in relationship with one another.
Yep.
And everything has a ripple effect. So yeah, surrender is the word, one of my favorite words with this work.
There you go. And it's not just as you said, it's a ripple effect in the rest of your world. And I think that's how you're supposed to be human, Nova. Like that's literally how you're supposed to exist in the world. You're supposed to exist in the world as someone who is trying to better understand the world and the people that you are in. Right. Yeah. And you're around. And so, and being open to knowledge and learning, and recognizing that knowledge and learning isn't one directional. It is, you know, and those types of things. I think that's how you're supposed to exist. And it is work, but it's human work. I think sometimes people go, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work. And it's like, no, that's literally your purpose as a human. This is part of having a brain that functions in the world. And when I say brain that functions, I just mean being born into the world. That's what I mean. Like part of being born into the world is learning how to get along with the people around you, learning how to make the world a better place for everyone so that we can all coexist.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it is labor, but it is part of the labor that comes with the label of existing still.
Yeah.
And so to be able to kind of disengage yourself from that, there is a huge privilege that comes with that. And it's not even privilege. It is, you're giving up an aspect of your humanity that is 100%. Fundamental.
100%. Most don't realize that though. Most don't realize that. And it's not to say that, you know, sometimes when the world, you know, sometimes with the amount of, you know, there's human rights crisis happening all of the time.
Yeah.
There's tragedy happening all of the time. There's human suffering happening all of the time. And I understand the overwhelm, but we don't have to deal with everything at once. We just need to make a decision on how to be better humans, depending on what our capacity is in that moment. Yeah.
My father always says, light the corner where you are, right? And that is, that's what you can only do what you can do in your, I think it's egotistical to look at all the things going on in the world and being like, they're all overwhelming me because I want to fix all of them. You're a one human being. You're one what are you fixing in your environment? What are you fixing at work when you go in your with your colleagues? What are you fixing in your friendship group? What are you fixing in your household? What are you fixing in yourself? Have you started there? That is a recognition of where you're placed in the world, right? And I understand being a super empath, I'm affected when I see things happening.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about being affected. I'm talking about people saying, well, there's so much, I just won't bother. I'll just keep living. Yeah, but that's what a lot of people do now. A lot of people are just like, oh, well, there's so much. If I bother doing that, then, you know, I'll just have to think about everything. That's very, very lazy. And it's actually, it's an excuse, isn't it? That's lazy. That's, you know... and I say lazy, and I don't even mean for black people. I'm not talking about black people when I talk about this in particular, because I think it's okay for black people on this planet to disengage, to be like, you know what? Let me just go to McDonald's. I don't care about the health effects. I don't care about that. I think it's okay. There is, I think we've racked up enough,
trauma.
store points. Yeah. We've got enough, XP points to kind of spend on disengaging
and laboring for everyone else.
Thank you. And I don't even care if someone says, yeah, but that person's parents and grandparents and great grandparents and great great grandparents weren't even experiencing that. No, they are. I don't care what you're trying to say. We are allowed. For everyone else, I don't believe the rule applies. I think whether you come from privilege or you don't come from privilege, whether you come from places where you've even experienced or been around racialized people or not, unfortunately, we live in a global community.
Yes.
And we are affected. Look, there are people right now sitting in a rainforest in Congo or sitting in a rainforest in the Amazon who are directly affected by us making plastic to cover our vegetables with. You can't say to me that you, because you're not the person who owns the company, that you don't, you know, it's not my fault. I'm from a poor family, so my parents never did anything to anyone. No, sorry about it. We are all implicated in the destinies of every single person that lives on this planet. Yeah. All of us are implicated, right? And so we have to collectively make that. It's not good enough. Especially if you're raising children, you're bringing children into the world. I don't want them learning critical race theory. What are you talking about? What do you write on their forms? Do you write human or do you tick white? What do you tick on their forms? If you're saying that you don't want them to learn about critical race theory, then that means fundamentally, when you're in your home, you are teaching your children about race in a way that enables them to see themselves not as a racialized white person and to reject any opportunity or special treatment that comes to them from by virtue of their skin color. You're teaching them to take on the burdens of all the people of color that they're around in their communities. Are you doing that? Until you are doing that, my dear, like that is not.
How did we meet? Was it
online? I don't even remember.
I can't believe we haven't met in person. Well, I can, but I can't because I just feel
it's hard
like
to,
kindred spirits
it's actually quite interesting, the number of people that I feel that way about. And that's one of the good things about the internet in some ways, right? It allows you to connect with people who are in line with your soul's walk. Who perhaps you wouldn't encounter because you are in your worlds, you're so isolated from the other people. Does that make sense? So there wasn't really a place where we could all kind of congregate in that way before.
Yeah.
And I think you might go into places where people say they're in alignment, but they're not really, and you don't find that out till too late. Whereas online...
Oh, gosh! You can do a bit more culling fast.
Yes.
I mean, I was just sharing that. You know, this has been, you know, it's nearly a year since suddenly people decided that there was, you know, racism was a public health issue. So it's been... sorry. It's been nearly a year. And a lot of my lifelong friendships, and I'm talking about people who attended my wedding, like people you celebrate life events with, have not survived. And some of these friendships that I formed with people online, some who've gone through my anti-racism course and we've ended up
forming a relationship. And it's like, I find it profound how you can be so deeply connected with people who, you know, in comparison to people that you went to school with. Yeah. Mm. And it's just, I'm just allowing that to settle. I'm just allowing that to settle. Because there's a grieving process that goes with it, but also there's a real joy in being able to connect with people who you are in sync with. Mm. And you've connected via the internet. It's quite profound, actually.
It's you know, it's funny. There are so many people I've met who have said this same thing about the period of the last year, that they've shed, Black women especially, shed so many friendships. It's not something that I could identify with at first. And it's also something that I resented when people were first telling me. I was over it. They're like, oh, you know what? I've lost friends. And I was so over it. I was like, how could you lose friends now? These people were never your friends. How did you not know that? How could you not feel that?
Like, I did the self-blame too.
Because that's where I was, and I'd been there for so many years. I had felt it and cut. Yes. And so the pain of the betrayal of so many people that I know, that I thought knew, that I thought you knew. So you mean that you were sitting and coffeeing with the enemy? Like that, in that kind of way. Meanwhile, you know, and it's that betrayal of kind of that being able to exist, or that envy in some ways of people who are able to exist in the world and not feel as burdened as I did, you know, was a real thing for me at first. And, you know, gradually, and this is learning, it was a growth thing for me as well, because it helped accentuate to me how deserving we are of spaces where we can just be and feel okay, right? Mm. In those friendships, though they may have ended now, in those friendships, you got something from them. You felt the veneer that prevented them from dissolving, right? Mm. Allowed you to have a space for friendship, allowed you to have a space for comfort, allowed you to have a space for all of these things and comforts that as humans we require. The sad thing is that the more you become aware of certain things, the more isolated you become.
Yeah.
And I realized that I do not, or would never begrudge a Black person space to feel comforted and supported. Yeah. Yeah. Regardless of whether it's under the auspices of thinking that your friends are cool with you being Black. Do you know what I mean? Like, your friends don't know, they don't see race, they don't see color, all of that kind of stuff that inhabits those kinds of interactions without, not consciously. Like, I don't think anyone is like, well, maybe some people are, but I think some people genuinely believe they're in friendships because people love them for who they are. And that may be the case, but they also don't think that color or race is coloring the relationship, even though race colors everything. Right. Mm. And so I would never begrudge Black people that space, which is why in some ways my practice about Black women specifically, not Black men, but Black women specifically, being with whomever they want to be with, if it provides them with comfort, space, and care and safety, because that is something that they are not afforded in the world in general, right?
Yeah.
It's really helped me to develop my understanding. This whole thing has helped me to develop my understanding and encountering people who have lost friendships and all those things, and these friendships have dissolved, or have seen different sides to their friends that they didn't believe could exist. Yeah. And some of the stories I hear, I'm like, yeah, but how could you not know? I mean, they're white. Like, how could you not think they grew up like this? How could you not? But I understand, like, I understand. And there's a part of me that in some ways feels a bit brokenhearted that so many Black people have had to go through that experience, because in some ways that's your, what else is going to be taken from Black people?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, what else do we have to have taken from us? It's it's a lot, like all of the time. And then now also this as well, and not just in a pocket, not just in gradually over years, like in the space of 1 year, like some people have had like 70% of their friendship groups eliminated. Some people have had to leave work. Like it's, why is so it that loss. Damage happening to us means that we have to endure trauma? What is that?
Yeah.
So for me, like, it's been a different type of learning and a different type of empathy and understanding and love and space that I have for Black people of all kinds, and who make particular choices, like the scrutiny I have for Black folks who make particular choices, especially when it comes to friendships and when it comes to alignment with white supremacy, like my scrutiny of them is not as deep as it used to be. Even though I still don't think it's okay, like I still think, oh, you know, it's not good, blah, blah, blah. I still, my scrutiny of them, my scrutiny is not directed towards them. It's directed directly at the system that created the avenue. As opposed to, I think there was a part of me before that did reserve some scrutiny for them, right? Because that's what we do.
Yeah.
And that's what we're taught to do.
Human nature.
We're taught to blame. Yeah. We're taught to do that. And so, yeah, it's a very, so online is a wonderful place, as you said, because it allows you, that's how me and Jamoke met, you know, online without the internet. And I think for disabled people in general, the internet has been a wonderful, wonderful space. One of my friends is writing a book about kind of sex dating and relationships, and she talks about online, she's known as Lala, let me explain. And she, in part of the book, like I'm reading the manuscript now, it's really a great book. But she talks about dating online, right? And I was just thinking about it as I was reading some of it and just thinking, you know, for this, and this is something Jamoke and I talk about, but the online space has been so instrumental for disabled activists, for disabled relationships, for disabled people in general, to not just access community, but for, I mean, online dating becoming a thing has opened up the world for a lot of disabled people as well, and allowed them to find and connect with people who see them, you know, and for activists, even just organizing in general, that has been helpful. A lot of intellectual thoughts that disabled people bring to the activism space, and actually, in terms of them being kind of Black disabled people being and Indigenous people being leaders in the development of thought, it's allowed them to get their flowers in ways that perhaps they wouldn't before. And so it's a great space. It can be a horrific space full of fodder, but it's also been instrumental in providing community and safety and love and developing those things that sustain us in ways that we couldn't access before, because we were in silos, because we, you know, live in non-majority nations, we're not majorities in some nations. And it's just like, it makes the world small so that you can touch the hearts of those who resonate with you. It's a beautiful thing, I think.
Thank you. How can people find out more about you and the work that you're doing with the Triple Cripples and ways that they can show up and support?
So people can find us on through our website, which is thetriplecripples.uk, I think. You can just Google the Triple Cripples and everything will come up on YouTube, our Instagram, our Twitter and talks we've done or whatever. We're currently working on a project called The Living Archive, which is us collating stories and the narratives of women, femmes and non-binary people of colour who live with disabilities. We're trying to make it a global, not lifelong project, but lots of years long project where we collect these stories and this data, and it's going to be an audio, visual, pictorial kind of archive that will also will have like exhibitions, hopefully yearly. And one of the reasons for this is because, as I said near the beginning, there's almost no data about specifically people of color If you're academically, for example, if I'm researching domestic violence, there's no specific data about Black disabled women, right? There's data about disabled women. There's data about Black women. There's data about Asian women. But there's no kind of data that kind of looks at the three intersections. And that's just for domestic violence, right? And so how can we serve communities? How can we do research? How can we be doing all of this academic work when that we don't have a pool of data to, you know, draw from? Once the stories become more than 100, it stops being anecdotal and it becomes actual research data, right? Yes. And so the idea is that this archive is something that people from around the world who are doing work, who are interested, not only can study from, but also so that we mark down in history that we were here.
Yes. Right?
We are often erased from history. Our narratives, our stories are erased completely. And we need our own source to say we were here. These are the lives we lived. This is how we existed in the multitude of ways that we exist. We are not a monolith. And we are valid in all of the ways that we exist. Yeah. We don't need to be Paralympians. We don't need to be this. We don't need to be that. We can be all of these things and more, right? And for those coming up behind to know that they are relevant, they are valid, and they are here, and they can take up space. They can see themselves visually, audibly. They can see themselves in motion. That is so important, that wholeness of being. And so, yeah, we're putting together an archive. People are allowed to donate to it via our PayPal.
What's your PayPal link?
I think it's forward slash triple cripples, but I need to check. I think it's paypal.me/triple cripples. And yeah, it's a labor of love, yes, but it's a very necessary archive. Like when we look at disability as Black people around the globe, like there are so many things that are unknown, but there are so many stories that go untold. The erasure of us. And when I say Black people, I am talking about Black people, especially because in the grand hierarchy of white supremacy, like we exist at the bottom. And as Jamal Khair and I always say, when you make things better for the margins of the margins, everybody else benefits. So if I'm 100%. Making sure that Black, disabled, non-binary, queer people in a lower economic bracket somewhere in a remote part of some nation, if I'm making sure that their stories are told and they are heard and that changes are happening from that for them, guess who else is benefiting? Every single person on the planet, including the environment, because disability issues are also environmental issues.
Yeah.
So, and it's all connected. So we're working on that. It's a huge undertaking, and all the support would be helpful if you have people who have spaces we can use to exhibit, if you know people who are good at editing or who know people who can print books, because we're also doing going to provide something written for people who want to engage with the information that way. Like, it would just be great to hear from people who just want to be part of or support the project, or who want to be part of the project itself. Yes. That would be amazing. But yeah, so that's what we're doing.
Well,
and being baby girls, as Jamal Khair would say.
Baby girls. What brings you joy?
What brings me joy? Oh my God, sitting in the sun if there's a breeze as well. Oh my gosh. The sun touching my skin. The minute, you know, I can be sick and miserable. I've got a condition that means that I am in bed a lot of my life, right?
Yeah.
And so being, even when I'm on the days when I'm able to sit up and maybe wheel out of the house and there's sunlight, and the sun, I can feel the warmth, not sunlight I can just see, but where it actually touches me and I can feel it a little bit, even if it's a little bit, like just the warmth and the sun and the breeze, and then seeing green of any kind, just it makes my world, it transforms my world in a way that I can't express or articulate. I can't. It just, it does something that just goes, Ooh. That's all. Mm. And yeah, so that's one of the things that brings me joy. But also seeing people laughing, especially seeing black people, groups of black people laughing, like when you don't know what the joke is, just seeing them laughing with abandon. I don't know, there's something about that that just makes me happy, seeing people enjoy themselves, just seeing them joyful and happy, and seeing beautiful people. I love seeing beautiful black people, and I guess I see black people as beautiful a lot, but especially beautiful black women. And something that brings me joy is going up to them being like, you know, you're very beautiful, and then being like, what? That, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I know, but I wasn't expecting someone to tell me, you know, yeah. And that kind of recognition of, you know what, thanks, sis, or, you know, yeah, I know it. Thank you. You're confirming what I already knew inside my mind, you know. I love that. And I love that connection of not needing, and for it not to have to mean anything, for it not to have to mean your best friends now, for it just another human to another human being saying, you know, I see you, I recognize you. You're here. I'm here. We're here. You know, you were here and recognizing your existence in that moment and giving you flowers and you don't have to earn flowers, you know, and it doesn't have to be about what the ideas of beauty are in the Western world or whatever we've been programmed to think. I just mean beauties, and there's things that I see and I admire. There are lots of different things. Sometimes there'll be a shoe or a color that I think is really beautiful, or, you know, and for me, it's important that I share that. I know what it's like to go through the world and have people not talk to you and to have... And I feel like that lack of connection, that disconnection from each other does us so much harm. And you never know what sometimes just being loving towards someone else, how that can affect their world and their life in that moment. You know, you never know. But specifically when I see that happening with black women, or when I see other black women saying it to each other, oh, I'm just like, yes! Yes! But yeah, those things bring me joy, and drinking water, those three things, being in water as well, showering, cleaning my skin, scrubbing it with soap and water every day, not sometimes, not just when it's hot, not just when I go to the swimming pool, every day. Not just when I fall in mud. Every day.
Not just when you can see it.
Not just when I can see it. Not just when I can smell myself.
Every day.
Not just when I have nits. All the time. All the time.
All the time. I love being in water. Oh, Kim, what a joy. I'm so glad. And you know what? I'm so lucky. Like, I'm under a lot of pressure with my book, and I really wanted to get this season out. And the only way I could get it out was to do these last minute recordings. And I'm very grateful that you could give time to me at such short notice so that we could have this conversation today. I really deeply, deep gratitude for that.
Nova, I have all the time for you. I have all the time for you. I have time for you. And I'm grateful that you even asked me. It's an honor that you would think my perspective relevant. Like, I'm often, I'm always flabbergasted when people ask me to speak. I'm like, me? I don't know much. You know. Like,
oh my gosh.
I just give my opinion. it's an honor, because I think, especially for people like you who are actually shaping the fabric of our world, and actually are, you know, sometimes we're making history and we're not recognized as the history, the subjects of history.
Wow,
whereas like you're a subject of history, right? You're, when we talk about books and names, and when we start naming people and talking about, you know, the way we talk about people, like, you're one of those names.
Wow.
And so it's an honor for me to be part of you making history.
Wow.
And I find that it's a beautiful thing. And it's wonderful that, you know, I don't know, maybe everyone who's around great figures in history feel this, but when they talk to them and being like, yeah, they're human like everyone else. You know, do you know what I mean? I'm sure they all feel that. And it's so nice to be one of the people who can be like, yeah, and they're human and they're lovely and they actually believe in the things they're talking about and they're dedicated and they're interested in it and it's real and it's not a propaganda thing and it's not a service. You know, just being able to be a witness, be a witness in the making of history, like, is a beautiful thing. And I feel honored and privileged for that. I do, very much so. So thank you for allowing me to be one of the people who can honor you.
Yeah, you're gonna set me off.
No, for real.
Yes.
For real.
Thank you.
But, you know, it's not everyone that can do the work, Nova. It's not everyone that can do the work. No. And it's, you know, you're doing work that is for the planet and, you know, for humans. And that can't be understated. Yes, you're working with specific, but it's what you're doing is transforming. It's transformative. It's transforming humans, the way that we think, the way that we interact. The education that you provide, the people that you're educating, the lives that it's going to affect, like, and the lives that it has affected and it does affect, like, that's not small stuff. That's not small stuff. And I know, I'm sure it probably feels overwhelming at times and it can be difficult, I'm sure. But just know that it's not you, it's the thing.
It's huge. It's bigger than any one of us.
Yeah.
I receive that with a lot of love. Thank you so much. Lastly, I've loved this conversation. I love the work that you're doing in the world. And more importantly, I love your spirit. Thank you so much for joining me today. And I am forever a fan. Of you and your world.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me, Nova.
You're very welcome. Continue to enjoy that sunshine and the joy of seeing black faces laughing.
Yes, I will. I will. I'll be one of them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Another episode of Conversations with Nova Reid Dunn, the incredible Kim Oliver from the Triple Cripples. And I hope you enjoyed listening to this conversation as much as I did recording it. So much gold in there. History lesson for you around how race and disability and worthiness are inextricably linked, as is everything. And the importance of not trivializing representation. I think that's one I just want to reflect on before we sign off for today. It's what I'm seeing a lot at the moment since summer 2020. You can really tell the difference between people who are wanting to better include, represent, learn from, and value in society and in work. And when that intention is coming from wanting to deeper connections and be more human, and when it's coming from a place of wanting to be seen to be doing something. And when it's the latter, when it's more about ego and optics, that's when we run the risk of trivializing. So without further ado, please support the work of Kim and Jumoke as part of the Triple Cripples. You can find them online, thetriplecripples.uk. And you can find them over on their Instagram, Triple Cripples, so no the on that handle. And also find out more about the Living Archive Project and how you might be able to support, get involved, or uplift. So without further ado, you know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you and you have learned something, please hop on over to your favorite podcast host and leave us a 5-star review, because they really help with SEO and ratings and getting this out to more people who need to hear it. You can connect with me over at Nova Reid Official, and also head to the show notes for links to all of the great things that my guests are doing. And that's it from me. We have one interview left and then a solo treat from me, and we're wrapping season 2. That's it from me. Take care of you. I will see you next time.